Welcome to Profit Boss Radio, where successful women have paved the road to their own financial freedom. Each week, your host, Hillary Hendershot, financial coach, money mindset expert, and experienced wealth manager, will help you discover the keys to the wealth and peace of mind you want and deserve in her no-nonsense and authentic style. Starting right now.
Welcome, I'm Hillary Hendershot. I'm your host. Today's the second episode in Women's Financial Freedom Month. I have for you a special interview with a woman named Manisha Thakur. She is a woman I've kind of watched from afar for many years. She is currently the Director of Wealth Strategies for Women at the Buckingham Family of Financial Companies. It's a relatively new role for her. She was also an author and a fellow financial advisor for several years. She's, of course, still an author. She's an ardent financial literacy advocate for women, and she's the author of two critically acclaimed personal finance books, On My Own Two Feet, A Modern Girl's Guide to Personal Finance, and Get Financially Naked, How to Talk Money with Your Honey. She has an MBA from the Harvard Business School, and she has a bachelor's from Wellesley College. She's also a CFA and a CFP. And if you listened to episode 33, you know what those two designations are. She lives in Portland, Oregon, where she revels in the amazing coffee scene. Her personal website is moneyzen.com. I loved how this interview unfolded, and I loved all of the things that Manisha and I were able to talk about. I think you're going to love it. We talk about everything from mistakes women make that prevent us from achieving financial zen to reasons to adopt the principle of simplification in your life. And we actually talk a lot about investing, and we kept it pretty Wall Street speak free. Without further ado, here's Manisha. Manisha, welcome to Profit Boss Radio.
Oh, Hillary, it is great to be with you.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk with you. And one of the things that you have been talking about for years is this concept of money zen. And so I would love to talk today about how women can find money zen, enjoy money zen, stay in money zen. And I think to start with, in order to understand how to get to money zen, we should probably start with talking about why women often don't get there or why they struggle with it. So what do you think are the core mistakes women make that leave them missing the mark?
I think there are three root causes, and I'll say them briefly and then we can dive into them if you'd like. The first is just general lack of financial education. And again, this is true for both genders. It's not as if men get deep personal finance education either, but what I've observed is that men and women tend to have generally around the same level of financial knowledge, but the confidence in it is so much greater for men and so much less for women. A lot more we can say on this, but reason number one for not having money zen in your life is a lack of financial education. Reason number two, which used to be my favorite reason of the three, is unrealistic media images. And by that, I mean that so many of the TV shows and magazines and movies that we watch portray lifestyles, quotes, average lifestyles that are mathematically impossible to achieve at the salaries people doing jobs in those lifestyles as depicted would actually be paid. In other words, if you watch a medical or a police or a legal drama, you'll see that every nurse and paralegal and policewoman has clearly had a full mani-pedi and blowout every single day before going to her shift. And so we are striving to match images that are completely unrealistic. So that keeps us from having money zen. And the third reason has now become my new favorite reason, which is that I think we confuse money and what I call real wealth. In the modern world, we've just become so decoupled from each other in terms of community and family and friends. We're all going so fast and we're in so many different directions. And unfortunately, what I think has happened is that so much of our identity has gotten tied up in money, and we've lost our real sense of what true wealth and life is. And as a result of that, we are lacking in what I call money zen. So at a high level, those are the three reasons.
Well, let's go back and touch on each one of them kind of in the order you presented them. First, lack of financial education. What would you say to, I don't think there is any other area of life where truly in order to be empowered, in order to navigate yourself effectively, you do need a small book full of general high-level knowledge. I mean, even for example, in the area of health, I work out, I get a massage once a month. I go to my doctor. I take the prescription she writes for me. I don't really have to know much more, even though the body of knowledge about obviously the medical books are deep. What would you say to someone who just really struggles to put this kind of knowledge under their belt, an artist or a creative type who finds it to be tremendously boring or unattainable?
What I would say is that the truth of the matter, and the financial services industry doesn't necessarily as a whole want us to believe this, but at the end of the day, the core steps that it takes to have good financial health are actually remarkably straightforward. They involve having an income of some sort for your household, living within your means, which means spending less than that income and having some amount to set aside for the future. Investing wisely, taking that amount for the future and appropriately allocating it between emergency funds, nearer term needs, and then that long-term savings piece that needs to be invested properly. And then protecting yourself, making sure that you have appropriate levels of insurance, estate planning documents, a good CPA who's helping you pull everything together. And when you boil it down, those are essentially the basic steps. What's happened is that there's so much jargon and there are so many financial products out there to help you do all of those very simple steps that any normal person's head starts spinning. Even if you have a Harvard MBA, it makes your head spin. And so I think the most important message that I want to get across is that the basics of good financial health are not difficult. And when you find a quality advisor to work with, you can actually even outsource all of the parts that can get particularly boring or tricky. And the reason I think for women in particular, this doesn't become so super clear is that when you look at just the way men are socialized, women are socialized, men start talking about money with each other at a much younger age, high school, college, early career, and we just don't chat about it with each other. And so I think a lot of the jargon feels foreign to us. And then the last piece is that so many of the industry leaders still, I cannot believe in this day and age, are male. And so what happens is a lot of the marketing and the analogies that are used to describe investing in particular have a very testosterone-laden feel to them. And so it just inherently turns a lot of us women, including myself, off.
Right. You know, I'm actually in a podcast, a kind of accountability group, and one gal in that group was really excited to hear that you were going to be on the show, and she was raving about one of your books, On My Own Two Feet. And so normally when I interview an author, I don't read the book before the interview because I like to be surprised. I want you to lead the interview and not me, even though this interview isn't about that book in particular, but I did read the book over the last week and I was really struck with how much information is in that book. And I thought to myself, this is a lot, right? And it's good. And I was thinking it might be overwhelming for a woman to think you need to memorize this, but maybe the key is really to keep it around, to dog ear it and use it as a reference or a resource when that particular area comes up.
And that's precisely, I think, the best way to use it. I wrote On My Own Two Feet with one of my dear, dear girlfriends from business school when we discovered that our fellow super smart female MBAs and girlfriends who were in medical school and law school were all asking the same basic questions. And we realized that, you know, trying to figure out how much house you can afford, how much car you can afford, what role credit cards should play in your life. And if you've got credit card debt, how you balance paying that off versus savings for the future, that these questions are universal. And so it's the rare person that is going to find absorbing all of this information in one setting really scintillating. But when it comes time to address any one of these key issues in your life, it's a great reference guide to go back to. And one of the things that we really tried to do with it was to remove jargon. And I think if there's one message that I really, really want to make listeners feel confident and aware of is that if you hear a word in finance that you do not understand the way it's being used, the odds are exceptionally high that the person who is sharing it with you may not fully understand the concept either. And that's why they're using the babbly speak. Personal finance advice and investing advice can and should be able to be explained in a straightforward manner. Doesn't mean you'll be particularly interested in it, but it should be simple. And if it's not, that's not your fault. Push the person who's talking to you to be clearer in their own expression of those thoughts.
Right. Just you don't, there's a lot of Wall Street jargon, and the fact that you can't define it off the tip of your tongue doesn't mean that you're stupid, uneducated, or naive. And as far as using books, this particular book as a resource, I hope folks listening do take that message to heart. Let's talk about unrealistic media images. It's a thought I hadn't heard before. And I know I've read an article about, for example, Carrie's lifestyle as portrayed on Sex and the City.
Yeah.
And how she was a freelance writer and how the income she obviously had on the show was something like four times what it was possible for her to even have, given
right.
what she did for a living. So I didn't know that someone like you would think this was pervasive. What made you identify this as a major failing point?
So I just started noticing this as I'm watching movies and TV shows, and I'm seeing people with jobs that are in the real world might pay $50,000, $60,000, $75,000 a year. And then I'm looking at the size of their homes, or if they're in major metropolitan areas, like New York or San Francisco or LA, I'm looking at the apartments that are being depicted in the condos, and I'm thinking, this math does not add up. And then I started taking a look at, I mean, just a simple example. I take a look at the legal drama Suits. And if you take a look at the clothes.
First of all, can we just say how beautiful those people are?
My point. Exactly. Okay, so to look like that, to have a physique like that, to be able to belong to gyms that would produce that physique, to have the hair and the skin and the nails, let alone the clothes. I mean, you can see the quality of the fabric and the stitching and the shoes and the handbags. That is not affordable on paralegal salaries in New York. It's just not. And so I have been putting this idea out there as much as I possibly can. I really think it would be a phenomenal economics dissertation for somebody to analyze a couple of shows and actually add up what it would cost to live to the standard that we're seeing, and then compare that to the salaries of the actual nurses and doctors and first and second year lawyers and paralegals that we're seeing. And the math just does not add up.
I had to stop watching that show when I was 8 months pregnant because they're just so damn thin. I went on a media cleanse from things that made me feel bad about me. So that show was one of them. Okay, your third point is about getting confused about money and true wealth. And I think what you're pointing to is kind of dovetails into the research that says that people are paying for experiences more than possessions, but also getting back to what's most important in life. Do I have it right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a David Foster Wallace quote that I love. He says, "If you worship money and things, then you'll never have enough. Never feel you are enough." And I think that we're hitting this tipping point in society where collectively we're realizing that. I mean, you can see it in the astronomical success of books like The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up and Spark Joy. You can see it. I live in Portland, Oregon. A big movement out here is towards tiny houses and really thinking, how much space do you actually need to be taking up? How many possessions do you really need to have? And I think what's happened is we've had consumerism run amok, and people are realizing that they are working in jobs they don't like to buy stuff to impress people they don't even really want to be around. And that whole vicious cycle is exhausting them. And so I think we're at a point where we collectively are asking ourselves, what is real wealth? And money is only one part of that definition.
So how tiny is your house?
I actually have downsized.
Did you?
Yes, I am recently divorced. which is a sad and painful experience, as many women can attest to. And previously I'd lived in Houston, Texas, where things are very large. And so it's not super tiny, but I'm in 1,300 square feet, which relative to, you know, the average 5,000 square foot home in Texas. But perhaps the more interesting thing is when I got divorced, I left with my clothes and my books. Literally, that's all I took. And so when I moved into this 1,300 square feet, I had my clothes and my books. And so I had to buy everything from scratch, like forks and knives and cups. And I was really deliberate about what I wanted to bring into this blank palette. And Hillary, it was amazing how little you actually need to be happy. It's been a really fun process of carefully curating things back into my life.
Yeah. And having being in the place where you are now, your ability to choose consciously what to bring in, I think that's powerful. I didn't know that was happening in your life. Thanks for sharing that with us.
And if I could just say one small comment on getting divorced, it was, and I'm going to try and say it without crying, but I probably won't be able to.
Okay.
It's the most gut-wrenching thing I have gone through. And I'll tell you that financially, I knew exactly what I was doing, and I was able to navigate things from a financial standpoint satisfactorily, but it still decimated me. And I cannot imagine going through divorce and not understanding the money piece. And yet that's exactly the situation that so many people go through. And so anyone who is thinking about or going through a divorce and listening to this podcast, one of the best pieces of advice I can give you from the bottom of my heart is to seek good financial counsel. A lot of times people rely on their divorce lawyer to help navigate them through the process. And honestly, you want to have a competent financial professional by your side because A, things can be complex, but B, divorce brain is really real. It's amazing what happens to you when you go through that kind of emotional experience. So I've always been passionate about this work and the work that we do. But when you're going through life trauma, and it could be widowhood as well, I just think the role that competent financial co-counsel can provide is invaluable.
Yeah, I haven't been divorced myself. I got married late, but I did have an engagement that ended when he moved out of the house during the day without telling me, and it broke me. I know I'm sorry for what you're going through, and I agree that there are times when all you can do is put one foot in front of the other, and divorce is probably one of those times. So you have your own financial advisor?
So I am lucky to work at a wonderful firm where I am an advisor, but we also, just like we don't operate on surgeons don't operate on each other, we all co-counsel each other. So yes, one of my colleagues served as my sounding board from a financial advisory standpoint as I was navigating all of this.
Good. I'm glad you have good counsel. So we talked about the three things that are the three mistakes that kind of keep women from achieving money zen. And then you shared something of your own. And money zen, like not having it, can really be costly in your life in terms of anxiety, health, peace of mind, relationships. I mean, I was speaking with a prospective client yesterday whose mother's money issues really have cost her relationship. So it's really worth it to stop now, whatever you're doing, and dedicate the time and effort that it's going to take you to get there, because you know, you can avoid this pain and struggles, a lot of it, but you can get to the place where the rewards are really big, right? I mean, you, Manisha, you have enough savings, you have enough income, you have kind of the benefits of good financial management in your life. And so can we just spend a minute or two talking about those benefits?
Absolutely. I mean, I will say first and foremost, the number one benefit was that it enabled me to get out of a household situation that was exceptionally unhealthy for me to be in. And I look back and I've always said that money gives women a voice and it gives women choices. And I am seeing, I'm turning 46 in a couple of days. And as I get older, I just keep seeing this over and over again, how empowering it is to have the financial wherewithal to vote with your money in terms of what products and services you want to use or where you want to be philanthropic or who you want to help in your family and friend of your family and friends and community. And then also the choices it gives you to leave relationships or career situations that are not working for you. And then not to make it all about the negative, it also opens the door to do some amazing things. Part of my healing, one of the things that I did, I rented places on Airbnb and VRBO in 7 different cities because I figured if I'm going to start all over, I'm going to start all over. And so I tested out different cities. I have started all kinds of new hobbies. I've been traveling all over the place. And money gives you the freedom to really reboot, reinvent, and re-energize whenever you need to.
What are some of the hobbies that you're liking the most?
Oh my gosh, I am addicted to yoga. I used to think yoga was like golf. Like, you don't sweat. Like, what's the point? And it's this amazing blend of meditation and movement. And I actually can see my triceps again. And I've met the most amazing people. I've also started hiking and biking and swimming. The Pacific Northwest is like a gigantic adult summer camp. It's wonderful.
That's so funny. I tried to do hot yoga one time in Hawaii and I had to leave. I know they all hated me as I left because you just don't leave in the middle of hot yoga. And it's just not my thing.
Okay. I will say this. I also am not a hot yoga person. And the one thing I will say for anybody who's listening, there is yoga for everyone. There are so many different types of classes. So if the first one doesn't hit you, don't give up.
Yes. Yes. I think my thing would be yoga for athletes. But so far, I like, you know, weightlifting for athletes and running for athletes. So you have a popular talk called Invest with Less Stress. And since investing well is one of the critical components of Money Zen, what are the top things you would want to share with women about investing and having less stress?
So I think the first thing to know is that 80 or 90% of your investment success is going to be driven by these factors. Number one, how early and often you start saving. The ability to have the cash flow to invest is a lot like building a snowball. The earlier in life you can start rolling that snowball, it just has more time to roll and roll and roll. So starting early and often is kind of the baseline, but I want to also say it's never too late. And then in terms of the tactically investing, I think it can feel so overwhelming when you listen to all of the jargon, PE ratios, dividend yields, discounted cash flow models, large cap, small cap, emerging market, alternatives. But at the end of the day, the single biggest decisions that will drive the majority of your success are as follows. Whether you choose to engage in active investing or passive investing. And passive investing sounds like you're doing nothing. So don't like that term.
Yeah, it's a bad marketing term.
Yeah, it really is. I prefer the term indexing. Or at Buckingham, where I work, we use the term evidence-based investing. But short version is this. There are two ways to invest. They're like driving in two different lanes of a freeway. One way to invest is like driving in the left lane of a freeway. You're weaving in and out, looking for an incremental advantage. That's active investing. The other kind of investing, which I'll use the term index investing, is like driving in the right lane with your seatbelt on. You're choosing a course and you're just sticking with it and you're going to capture your fair share of the movement in that lane. And when you're driving, inevitably what happens is both cars, the crazy one in the left lane and the one in the right lane, hit the red light or the train crossing at the same time. But the car on the left has a driver with palpitating heart and sweaty armpits. And the driver on the right is probably listening to NPR or podcast of Serial, and they're humming along. And in investing, the results show us that 9 times out of 10, you get the same or better results engaging in an indexing approach, a right lane style of investment with a lot lower costs and I would argue a lot greater peace of mind than being in the left lane. So I always encourage people. I started off my career institutionally in the left lane. I've done a complete 180. I only invest in the right lane in index funds myself. So that's the first decision. Do you want to drive? Do you want to invest in the left lane or the right lane? The next most important decision you make is what mix do you want to have between stocks, bonds, cash, broadly speaking, in your portfolio? And a really simple rule of thumb to see if you're roughly on track is 110 minus your age. And that number is roughly a starting point for what portion of your portfolio would be in stocks. And if you're dramatically off that number, then you want to ask yourself why. There could be some very, very good reasons, but that's a good, easy litmus test to use. And then the third piece is within the stocks, the bonds, and so forth, you want to be diversified. And the way I think about it is you're eating vegetables and fruits, but all you eat are broccoli and cantaloupe. Your skin might start to turn green or orange. You want a range of nutrients in your body. And it's the same thing with your investments. And when you boil it down, making the right decision, and I would argue strongly that the right decision is to drive in the right lane, picking the right investment approach between active versus indexing, picking the right, the technical term is asset allocation. The plain English version is mix between stocks, bonds, and cash. And then having the right level of diversification, the right nutrient content within each of those broad buckets. That's 80 to 90% of investing right there. And so the steps are actually not that difficult. The problem is choice is so overwhelming. And that's where I think professional financial advice can be so invaluable. A lot of times people will think, what am I paying for? And in the past, people paid for financial advice to try and beat the market. And I would argue that's such an antiquated approach. Now, I would argue the ideal reason to hire a financial advisor is to make the right decision on those three big questions. If you get those right, you've got a lot of leeway around everything else.
So I'm actually a person who drives in the left lane. I don't invest in the left lane, but but I have a heavy foot. And for those of you who are maybe new to the show, I do actually have an entire episode dedicated to what Manisha is calling right lane investing, evidence-based or index fund investing. That's episode 26. So if you want to go back to episode 26 and hear a whole conversation about that, you can and should. But can we just put a little bit of the high-level data trend in so people understand really, truly, how do we know that right lane investing is better than left lane?
Oh, it's irrefutable. I mean, what happens is there are all kinds of organizations. Dalbar is a very famous one. Morningstar Analytics shows it as well, that literally go back at the end of every quarter and take a look at mutual funds. Mutual funds are like financial smoothies. They're investment vehicles through which you put in money and the manager of those vehicles buys various different kinds of stocks or bonds based on their strategy. And so what happens is you can go back at the end of each quarter, it's publicly available data, and you can take a look at how many managers who were trying to drive in the left lane actually did better than the vehicles available in the right lane. And by the way, the average fund in the left lane has a fee of about 1.3% right now, whereas the average index fund, I'm using average very loosely because you can actually find many with lower numbers than this. Let's call it 0.3%. So there's a 1% more charge to be in the left lane. And each incremental 1% more that you spend in fees over an investing lifetime, over a 30-year investing lifetime, eats up literally 20% of your ending value. So we know two things. One is on a rolling quarter-by-quarter basis, the data consistently shows us that many more funds in the right lane beat the ones in the left lane over rolling 3, 5, 10-year periods. And there's a mathematical headwind that you start off with by being in the left lane, which is a fee that is typically 1% higher. So the data is just so incredibly clear. And for people who would like to read more about this, one of the best sources is John Bogle, who founded the firm Vanguard. And he's got a number of different books out. They're all short and pithy on investing. And he does a really great job in all of his works of giving the long-term historical data and analytics on why right lane investing is, as many people would call, the winner's game.
So John Bogle's books are great. And I would say he's not quite as dedicated to not using Wall Street speak as you or I, but it's a good place to start. The way I kind of describe it is to say, look, the smartest minds in the world of finance have, at this point, made it really easy for you to take advantage of decades of research and invest far more successfully than anybody was doing just a few decades ago. I mean, when Bogle founded Vanguard, he was laughed at. He was laughed at on Wall Street. And in fact, Vanguard is kind of like the anti-Wall Street. So, you know, why would you not snap up this opportunity that really, as you said, the evidence is irrefutable? And you know, Manisha, because you were one of those managers, right?
Yeah. I mean, I spent the first 18 years of my career on the, in the left lane side as what's called a buy side equity analyst, and then an institutional portfolio manager. So I was part of the cog out there in the great Wall Street machine that was managing money for, in theory, the really smart money, the large corporations, endowments, foundations, accounts that were $50 million, $250 million, $500 million in size. And these entities would hire investment consultants to help them identify the best active money managers. And when I look back at the results, and I worked for great firms, but when I look back at the results, honestly, net net, after you take out fees and expenses, all of our clients would have been better off if they had just bought index funds to begin with. And that's when I really realized, oh my gosh, the existence of the active management business is a testimony to the fact that hope truly does spring eternal, and people are hoping to find that four-leaf clover. But as we've seen in the shift of funds from not just individuals, but also from institutions, more and more people are starting to wake up to this reality. And in many senses, it's not so different from the trend we started off talking about at the very beginning of the show, this voluntary simplicity movement and people getting back to the core things that really matter. And investing in many senses has just become way too complicated, so much so that it's actually, in a sense, imploded upon itself.
So I was raised into right lane investing. My father was a successful fiduciary advisor. And so I was a convert before I had a driver's license. But you spent 18 years doing the opposite. What caused your change of heart?
It was a combination of things. One was the data. I mean, just kind of slowly waking up to seeing that I worked for some of the best private firms, so firms that would be household names, but really elite firms, kind of Ivy League type firms managing money for institutions, and just seeing the results. Another part of it was this growing internal desire. I've always been guided by three principles: simplicity, small joys, and financial independence. And that's what I've always wanted in life. And as I started to learn more about indexing, I realized it was the perfect embodiment of simplicity, small joys, and financial independence, in the sense that it's such a powerful strategy. And there's also something karmically that I like about it as well, which is that it's not about trying to grab more than your fair share or beat somebody else out or clobber the competition. It's about harvesting your fair share of the market's return in a variety of different asset classes. And there's something about that that I just find really appealing from a human standpoint. I'd rather be that kind of person than somebody that's trying to, you know, lunge first for the biggest lollipop.
So I wasn't actually even planning to ask about this, but now all of a sudden I'm remembering an article that you once wrote that I was honestly floored when I read it, and I can't believe it didn't get more press. But you are one of the only women I've ever seen write about your recommendation for women who want to do socially responsible investing, or what's called social impact investing. And I would describe your recommendation as a no, or a why would you do this? Because it ultimately is that left lane investing. Do I have that right?
So it's interesting. I sit on the investment policy committee at Buckingham, and I've been tasked with really diving into this subject. And I have really changed my opinion over the last 2 years, but that's because the product offering has changed dramatically over the last 2 years. In the very early days of socially responsible investing, I look back and I see that there were a handful of firms that really were trying to do the right thing, but they used a left lane approach. So I just fundamentally felt like, well, it's great that you're trying to do good, but you're trying to pick individual companies, individual fixed income instruments. And I didn't believe in that approach. I was also really concerned by the fees that were being charged in this area. In some cases, the fees were high simply because there weren't enough in assets in order for the organizations to stay afloat. They had to charge 1.5, 2.5, sometimes even 3% fees. So I felt like women who by a wide margin expressed more interest up until now in this style of investing were being taken advantage of. But what's happened over the last couple of years is there's been this literal sea change. There's more interest. There's more acknowledgement that companies that pay attention to environmental, social, and governance issues actually have healthier bottom lines. And there are now many more right lane ways to take advantage of an interest in investing in companies that pay attention to these kinds of issues. So if we rewound the clock to the time that I wrote that article, I feel like it was absolutely the right advice for the time. And I am thrilled to say that times have changed and now there are right lane offerings.
Good. Well, I'm glad I asked about that. So let's make sure that we also address what you talked about earlier, which was essentially how a 1-point difference in the underlying cost of your investment portfolio can translate to a 20% decrease in your terminal values of that investment portfolio. Now looking at the opportunity women have to pay for financial advice, and you've been very pro financial advisor in this conversation, what's the financial advisor's role for a woman in that process of getting to money's end, and how can the woman think about the paying of those fees?
Sure. So I need to start off by saying every time somebody asks me, are you a financial advisor? Quite honestly, my first reaction is to cringe. And then I want to say, but I'm one of the good ones. And so I want to acknowledge that there is, as a whole, the financial services industry, and particularly the financial advisory industry, does not have a good reputation. And that less than stellar reputation is well deserved. And the reason is that financial advisors, as it currently stands, can be held to one of two different standards. And most people don't intellectually know this, but they viscerally know this. One standard is called suitability, and that's what the majority of advisors are held to. And advisors operating under that standard have to make recommendations that are suitable, but not necessarily in the client's best interest. They could be in the best interest of that advisor's pocketbook or that advisor's firm. The other type of investor or advisor is the one that Hillary, you have grown up under the tree of, and I have, which is the fiduciary standard, which is a legal standard requiring you to put the client's best interest first. So I want to be really clear that I am pro fiduciary financial advice. I am not pro suitability financial advice. So the first question to ask any potential advisor is, do you operate as a fiduciary? And if they say no, you do not want that advisor, in my opinion. The role of the advisor, I would argue, is to help you avoid exceptionally costly mistakes. And so the thing about investing is that the impact comes in very lumpy ways. So I'll give you an example. If you look at the market over any rolling 40-year time period, the best 20 days are 90% of the returns come in the best 20 days over any rolling 40-year time period. And so, and nobody knows when those days are going to be. So what you're paying for, in my opinion, with a financial advisor is to have somebody set up a plan that is appropriate for you, that you understand. So you have the confidence to stick with the plan so that when the inevitable unexpected events happen, like Brexit, and you have market turbulence like we saw not so long ago, you don't have a knee-jerk reaction to pull yourself out of the market and then miss the upturn. Or said slightly differently, I think the role of the advisor is to help you understand where you are today, where you want to clarify, where you want to be in the future, and understand at a very specific granular level what action steps you have to take in order to get from where you are today to where you want to be. And that's a very different paradigm than what existed when I got out of undergrad in the early 1990s, when advisors really viewed their job as focusing on your investments and trying to help you beat the market. What advisors, quality advisors do today is help you figure out the financial pieces that need to be put into place in order for you to live the life that makes your heart sing. That's what you're paying for, in my opinion, with quality financial advice.
Also, the ability to have someone to kind of quarterback, it's bad to use a sports metaphor, probably in a conversation about Money Zen for Women, but to synthesize all the advice that you get, legal advice, tax advice, investment advice, economic advice, to make sure that none of it contradicts or leaves you left out in the cold.
Precisely. I think about it as your financial advisor is your financial general physician, and the other financial doctors that you have include your CPA, whoever's helping you with insurance, whoever's helping you with estate documents, and a really good financial advisor will serve as air traffic control and make sure that all of those different pieces are coordinating appropriately.
What would be kind of the one piece of advice you would want to leave with people?
I think that I have had a real sea change in terms of how I think about money. Early on, I used to think about money in a very testosterone-oriented way. It was simply a result of having gone to Harvard Business School and working on Wall Street. I viewed that number as a metric of success, and the higher, the better. And I've done this complete 180 where I view money now as our life's energy. Most of us get money in our lives because we work for it. And when we spend our money, we're spending our life's energy. And I view the whole process of dealing with your personal finances as really honoring that life's energy and figuring out how to squeeze the most amount of joy out of the resources that you have, whatever those resources are. And for me, that's been a real sea change, because joy can come in so many different ways. And most of them have nothing really to do with more. They have to do more in terms of more money. They have to do with more in the sense of more connection, more intimacy, more humanity, more giving, more caring, more loving. And I think that a lot of women look at money, and because the industry is still charged by such a testosterone-driven engine, the way I used to, and it just feels yucky. I'm hoping with this concept of money zen, which I define as financial calm and confidence, I can do some small thing to help give people an alternative definition as to why they should pay attention to this part of their overall well-being.
Wow. Thank you. You are an incredible voice in this chorus of voices leading the charge for financial empowerment. And that word empowerment really is kind of the essence of my message and my reason for hosting the show. So it's an honor to have you here. Thanks for sharing personally and professionally. I really appreciate it.
Well, and Hillary, I just want to say what a treat it is to speak with you. You are also a pioneer, and your clients are very lucky to get to work with you.
Thank you. So wasn't that incredible? It is amazing to be a part of the evolution of financial services as it truly grows up and becomes much, much more inclusive. And I would echo Manisha's experience that the industry used to be 100% about higher and higher returns, which is implicitly being 100% about more and more money. And while most financial advisors still consider that to be their role, I don't. And to illustrate that, I'd like to tell you a story about a client of mine. This woman came to work with me after having lost a quarter of her wealth, more than $500,000, because it had been poorly invested by her former financial advisor. She was already retired, so she needed this money. She couldn't just go earn it back. She has a mortgage and a lifestyle to protect. So I, of course, was very excited to work with her, and we got started building her evidence-based investment portfolio. But this woman had a long history with Wall Street active portfolios. And even though I assured her that her experience would be world-class, she was still nervous and anxious. And I think it was justified. She had believed the things her former advisor had said, and they hadn't come true. And the impact on her life was huge. Over the past several years, I've worked closely with her other trusted advisors to get her a trust and a medical directive and long-term care insurance to protect her money and her choices and her heirs. And we've continued to pay her a healthy and consistent retirement income. And she was in my office the other day, and I said to her that I kept expecting to hear from her because it used to be that she would forward me some kind of article from the news media at least once a month. Some article that predicted financial Armageddon or some story about an actively managed mutual fund that she thought might be a better solution for her. But you see, these were all a product of her past training when she was working with Wall Street advisors. And my message to her has been 100% consistent over time. And her financial experience has been 100% consistent. The market goes up and the market goes down, but your mortgage payment doesn't, does it? And with this particular client, because I've been able to come through on my promises and my message and her experience have both been consistent, she said to me, "Hillary, I just don't worry about it anymore. I don't worry about money anymore." And that, my friend and fellow profit boss, is the aim of my professional career. It's the goal I seek with every single client, that you should have a successful financial outcome, you should have the results that you want, and you should be able to trust on a day-to-day basis that your experience is going to continue to be consistent. So if that sounds like an experience you'd like to have, if that sounds like the kind of financial advisor you'd like to work with, I'm inviting you to schedule a brief chat with me to find out. I promise to be absolutely clear with you if I'll be able to provide value in your situation or not. And frankly, I would just love to connect with you, my Profit Boss audience. If you'd like to talk about how you can stop worrying about money, I invite you to schedule a free 15-minute call with me today to find out if I might be the right financial advisor for you. To schedule your appointment, call 877-569-5508. Again, 877-569-5508. That number is in the show notes for today's episode at hillaryhendershot.com/34, or just call now, 877-569-5508. My team is excited to take your call and help you schedule an appointment at a time that works for you. Once again, that number, 877-569-5508. I hope to hear from you. I really look forward to talking with you about maximizing the chances that you'll achieve all the things that are important to you.
Thank you for listening to Profit Boss Radio, where creating success on our own terms happens every day. You're not alone in your journey to a rich life, and that's why Hillary is here to add value in each and every episode. See you next time on the podcast for women and money.